Hello and welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I'm your host, Madalina Jakob, managing editor of DebtWire North America. I'm glad to be joined today by Brian Resnick, partner in Davis Polk's restructuring group and head of liability management and special opportunities practice. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you for having me, Madalina.
Brian, let's start the discussion by talking about how you transitioned from a music background into law and eventually into the restructuring and finance practice.
Sure. I did come to what I do now through a little bit of an odd route, having been a professional musician for a number of years. I grew up as kind of like a rock and roll drummer, just played in rock bands throughout middle school and high school. And then at a certain point, I transitioned to the classical percussion instruments, xylophone, marimba, timpani, and all that stuff. And it really happened when I went to Interlochen Arts Academy, which I went to first for the summer camp after 10th grade, and then for boarding school, 11th and 12th grade. And then I became really into the classical percussion instruments, but still played a lot of rock and roll drums and jazz and everything. So I was kind of into all types of music. I then went to Northwestern for 2 years as a music major and transferred to Juilliard, where I spent 5 years getting my bachelor's and master's. And while I was at Juilliard, I started playing professionally pretty early on. And my main thing was playing Broadway shows, mainly because I was able to play all these different styles. And in a Broadway pit, you're often going back and forth between rock, jazz, show tune stuff, classical, and you had to play all these instruments. And so, for example, in Miss Saigon, I played 48 different instruments.
I wish you brought an instrument today here.
Yeah.
to play a little
bit. Yeah, nothing here. And I played like Elton John's Aida. I played Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. I played drum set there, which was all jazz and funk music, all while at school at Juilliard playing in the orchestra there and chamber music. And I also played in a punk rock band at that time down at CBGB's and other clubs in the village. And after I graduated from Juilliard, I only had 1 year then out in between schooling, even though I had a full-time, very active music career. I thought I wanted to add something to it. I did not think that I wanted to be a corporate lawyer or a partner in a corporate law firm. I thought I wanted to go into the entertainment industry and in some sort of high up C-suite level position, running a music studio or a movie studio or something like that. I wanted to do it while playing. I thought I was going to have a dual career of something in the business world and continuing my playing. So I thought about a bunch of different ideas and things to do from there. And I ended up messing around with the LSAT book and deciding that maybe law school would be a good route into the entertainment industry and something that I could do while playing. And
especially having your father, right, as a lawyer and maybe as an inspiration
right.
to you.
That's right. My father was a bankruptcy law professor and a lawyer, but I wasn't really thinking so much about the law or being a lawyer. I was focused on my full-time music career and wanted to sort of get something done on the side that would position me well for perhaps the business world. And so I ended up applying to law schools only in New York, and I got into Columbia Law School and I enrolled there and I was playing full time while there. My music career actually even grew, which was kind of interesting. I played a few times on Saturday Night Live. I was playing with a whole bunch of sort of pop stars and doing some touring as well, which was a little bit tough with law school. I managed to sort of get it all done. And then having the twins, it was like a tremendous amount of work at home. And so when I started law school, I kind of had these dreams of what I could do when I came out. I ended up getting married to my wife during my 2L year, and we had twins in my 3L year, and I had the job offer from Davis Polk. I summered there in 2002, and you know, so graduating with a family of four felt very different than sort of my mindset was when I started law school, as
Definitely.
You can imagine. And I figured I would give Davis Polk a try and you know,
follow up on your dreams later.
Exactly, and could be, you know, a good stepping stone to other things if I wanted to ultimately, you know, get into the entertainment industry or do other things. So I tried up at Davis Polk, not knowing whether I would stay for, you know, 2 years or life. And it seems like the latter is the way it turned out. So it was kind of interesting because I think most people start their first year at a law firm like Davis Polk and it's incredibly demanding.
Exactly. Work is life.
Yeah. So for me, exactly. But for me, I gave up music like immediately as soon as I started at Davis Polk. And it was just a huge change and a huge shift. But I had been doing so many different things at that time that actually being able to focus on one thing at Davis Polk was in a way a little bit easier because I'd been doing so many different things. And then, of course, my spare time was spent raising twins. And then my daughter was born when I was a second year associate. So I had a family of five by the time I was a second year associate. So that brings me to my early years at Davis Polk. I did a rotation in M&A and I really liked that. I ended up working on the Sony BMG merger. which was interesting given my background. And then I did a rotation in what was then called the bankruptcy group, bankruptcy and workout group. And I had an incredible experience. The two partners in the group at the time were Don Bernstein and Marshall Huebner, of course, still at our firm. And
great mentors.
Yeah, incredible mentors. And they really took me under their wing. And I ended up just really having an incredible experience that 6 months. And I decided to join the group and, yes, follow in my father's footsteps into the bankruptcy profession.
I guess it was unexpected for him, right? After
it was a little bit unexpected, yes. But my parents were incredibly supportive of my music career. They used to come to all my shows and performances. And, my dad would show up at CBGB's at midnight wearing his suit, coming from Fried Frank. We both looked pretty out of place, but at least my hair was long at the time.
So you talked about your early days at Davis Polk. What was it like building a small restructuring team into a 70-plus lawyer practice? What were the key milestones?
Sure. So it's been an incredible more than two decades. Our group was about eight lawyers with, two partners and just a handful of really strong associates, including Damian Scheibel, who was, 2 years ahead of me. And so, the four of us are obviously still there from that era. And we were mostly representing banks, did a lot for, JP Morgan and other banks and sort of the big dip facilities, Adelphia, Enron. And it was a great part of our practice. And then early on, we got the Delta Airlines case and Marshall sort of took the lead on that one. And Damian and I worked on it and others. It was an incredible experience. And it really started that era of building out our company side practice. And then we continued to grow. And then when I was a senior associate, the financial crisis hit and we were right there on the forefront representing the Federal Reserve with respect to AIG. I was deeply involved in that. We were very involved in Lehman Brothers, representing Lehman Brothers Europe. That was just an incredible time to be a senior associate in the bankruptcy space. It was very organic growth. It wasn't like any particular year. We just stepped up massively and we went from, sort of an eight-person group to a 70-plus lawyer group over the course of, 22, 23 years. And then part of it was because we expanded into representing hedge funds and ad hoc groups. After I made partner in 2011, after Damian and Tim Growlick made partner in 2009, the three of us, I think, went out there and into the market and really we realized that, having represented agents until then, agent banks, we had a lot of experience working with these hedge funds through our agent representation, because in those days, representing the agent also meant you were effectively representing the lender group, the term lenders. And so we got to know a lot of the lenders through those representations. And that was about the time then that the agent role sort of changed and the ad hoc group really developed.
And maybe we took over or had a bigger stance.
Yeah. So that became a very material role in cases separate and apart from the agent. And we were able to really build on our relationships and expand them and really develop that part of our practice, which has and continues to be huge. And we're top one, two, or three, depending on the month you want to look at in terms of the league tables on the ad hoc group side. So we're now 11 partners in New York. We've recently expanded. We have two restructuring partners in London. And so we're really build on our global and international practice. And I think we've really built the deepest bench of any restructuring group out there. It's just an incredible group. We've been together, many of us, for quite a long time. We have incredible associates and counsel, and we've just built such a deep bench and such a great group over the years.
Wonderful. So we took a leap back in time, but let's come back to the current state of affairs and talk a little bit about how has the volatile market environment impacted deal flow and liability management exercises.
Yeah. So look, it's been a very, very active few years on liability management. I mean, you could look at it as sort of like a 5-year trend in a sense, because I think even though we did some of these deals before 2020, we did Not Your Daughter's Jeans, which was one of the first up tiers. I mean, there were cases like J. Crew. I think liability management as we know it today really took off in 2020, and it was due to COVID, of course, where you had these businesses that were good businesses before COVID, and then their revenue went to zero. The name of the game was basically buying time, particularly on the private side. If a sponsor owns a portfolio company that needs to sort of ride out the wave, can you loan money or get money into the company to give them time or maybe get a maturity extension in order to try to ride out the sort of zero revenue time? And so that took off, immensely in 2020 and still to this day remains an incredibly high percentage of our practice, we're probably doing, 75% or so, out of court deals. We're now, of course, the restructuring group. We're not the bankruptcy group anymore because we do a lot more than bankruptcy. And so many of our deals are out of court. And I think we were one of the first firms to really pioneer having finance capabilities within our restructuring group and having our associates and counsel in our restructuring group be incredibly knowledgeable about, credit agreements and the liability management transactions. We don't farm that out to other groups. We work closely with other groups, but the people in our group are incredibly knowledgeable about it. And with the addition of Christian Fisher, he leads our finance group within our restructuring group. And so we still work with people like Ken Steinberg outside of the restructuring group on finance and liability management, but we have that capacity in our group. And it's really helped us develop tremendous market share. And so in the past, now you ask about sort of current volatility. I mean, it depends on sort of what time period we're talking about. April was an incredibly crazy month. There's always a little bit of a lag, right, in terms of the effect that something like that has.
How did you navigate the month of April with the ever-changing tariff policies?
I think, it created a tremendous amount of uncertainty. That's a no secret, which I think had multiple effects. I mean, we were in the middle of doing a whole bunch of deals that sort of went on pause a little bit as companies tried to figure out what their go-forward EBITDA would potentially look like and how they wanted to play the situation given the uncertainties in the market. And then at the same time, we had sort of new clients come to us and, new creditor groups forming, companies that I think prior to the announcement of the tariffs were kind of sitting on the sidelines. And then you had companies where, 65% of their business is, related to goods that go through China, for example. And, we'd immediately get calls on those names that we would not have gotten calls on, a few days before. It was definitely pretty hectic and kind of remains that way.
Are there some sectors that you feel are more impacted?
Yeah, so retail and consumer products, the auto industry, definitely. And, we continue to be heavily involved in other industries that are maybe less tariff sensitive, but are just sensitive to the whole economy. But I think those are the areas that we're really seeing.
Maybe for some of these companies, an LME won't be enough. Even a Chapter 11 filing where you shed more liabilities, I feel like, and you clean the balance sheet in a more comprehensive way could be a solution. But even then, you emerge and then you have to pass the cost to the consumers.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. In the old days of our practice, companies would often file for bankruptcy because they couldn't borrow money anymore outside of bankruptcy. You needed the bankruptcy to be able to do a debtor in possession financing. Now, with the liability management transactions, where you have documents that permit basically raising of financing on a senior basis, you have situations where even though the existing debt, whether secured or unsecured debt, is seen as being potentially underwater and not necessarily going to be paid in full, the company has the ability to borrow senior debt. So the new money is money good, right? Almost like a DIP. Exactly. That's what liability management, you can think of as being a DIP without needing 364 of the bankruptcy code. The documents effectively provide for the ability for senior priming financing, either structurally or through an up tier. I don't see a ton of companies who have the ability to do one of these liability management transactions, instead choosing to file for bankruptcy. It's possible and it could happen, but by and large, if they're able to do an LME and get it done, they do it. It gives them a new lease on life and the potential for avoiding bankruptcy. I think bankruptcies have become very, they're costly and there's a lot of private credit money that's available to these companies at rates that are passable for companies in this position. And so I think we're still seeing a lot of liability management, even when there seems to be a relatively low likelihood that the company will ultimately be able to avoid bankruptcy.
And you just mentioned liability management exercises and how they evolved since 2020. If we just look 5 months back, do you feel like we're seeing more inclusive, more pro rata deals post CERTA and Mitel?
Yeah, so I guess 5 months would be post December 31st,
yes, exactly.
2024.
Happy New Year.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
Like an interesting time.
Exactly. I think we're still seeing well, we're still doing deals and we're still seeing deals. I don't think those cases, CERTA has stopped the deal flow. It's led to kind of other ways of getting deals done. Remember, the early days of 2020 were all about the leave behind deals, right? It was, you know, deals like CERTA that a small majority got the benefit of an up tier and left behind the minority to basically do nothing but sue because they had to sue because they weren't getting anything. We haven't been doing those deals for now a couple of years. It's really migrated to the tiered recovery transactions where the ad hoc group, the steering committee, the in crowd, whatever you want to call them, will negotiate a deal and they'll get the best economics and then they'll offer differentiated economics to others who come in after the fact. And the goal is to get to high 90s%, 100% or close to it. And then you're basically, anybody who comes in to the deal releases everybody else. And so there's no risk of litigation when everybody comes into the deal. And that has become the name of the game over the last 2 years or so.
Since we talked about CERTA, can you maybe give us some examples of some creative work around structures that you've seen post-CERTA, post the decision?
Yeah. So we've done several deals since then. Typically, the pro rata sharing provision of the credit agreement would prohibit the up-tiering aspect of a liability management transaction that is structured as an up-tier, right? So when the lenders who are providing the new money up-tier their existing loans, that's done as an exchange with the company. And if the credit agreement prohibits doing that without pro rata sharing, without those lenders sharing the benefits of that with the other lenders, then you need an exception to the pro rata sharing. And the exception that was used in CERTA and in many deals that followed was the open market purchase exception. And the Fifth Circuit on December 31st said that doesn't work. Since then, we've done a couple of things. I mean, many credit agreements include amend and extend or refinancing provisions that allow the company to create a new class of term loans under the credit agreement only with participating lenders. And once the loans of the participating lenders are placed into a new class of term loans or retranched, the company typically then has the ability to repay or refinance the new class of term loans without having to repay the other class of term loans, which was held by the others. Now, these provisions can vary case by case, and you know each credit agreement is different. So it has to be, you have to read it carefully and sort of thread the needle. But other types of provisions could include permitted debt exchange, which allows the company to refinance term loans with notes, or there are Dutch auction provisions that allow the company to repay or exchange term loan at a discount. Some of these provisions include some type of pro rata element, but some do not. So every credit agreement is different. Those are the things that we've been looking at. You know, it'll be interesting to see if they ever get tested because it requires holdouts who are willing to spend the money and time to hold out and sue. Because in most of these cases that we've been doing, we get very high percentage approval.
Have you used co-ops in these recent deals that you were mentioning to kind of get the deal together and through the finish line? Do you think that helped or you kind of strayed away from using them?
I'm not going to talk about the specific deals because that's the info is confidential. But co-ops, I don't really view them as sort of facilitating getting deals done. They're more protective of the lenders, ensuring that the company does not play the lenders off of each other and do a deal with some lenders and not others. So I think they're more protective. A related point is, you know, a lot of these liability management transactions used to be proposed by lender groups. So we'd get a 51% lender group together, we'd sign a co-op, and then we would go into the company and say, hey, how about we do this up tier. Times have changed, and I think many of the liability management transactions are now pushed by the sponsor. And, you know, companies view the flexibility in their debt documents as an asset of the company to be used to drive value and preserve what is potentially an out of the money option if you're dealing with a company that is potentially insolvent, or if the company is, you know, is solvent or barely solvent, you know, increase the likelihood that equity remains in the money and increases in value. And so with these sponsor pushed deals, what you have is the sponsor basically looking at the deal away, which is typically a drop down of assets where the credit agreement will permit them to take assets out of the collateral pool, put them into a new subsidiary and finance the assets at that subsidiary level at a structurally senior basis. And there's a ton of private credit capital that is proactively trying to seek out these transactions, and sponsors can either fund it themselves or use private capital. And so with the sponsors having the ability to do that, it allows them to go to the lender group and say, we could do that, but would it make more sense for us to do a deal? The lenders are the only ones who can provide discount and the only ones who could provide a maturity extension. To some degree, it makes sense for both sides for the lenders to do a deal. But if the lenders are not willing to provide a deal that the sponsor finds attractive, the sponsor does have the option of doing the deal away. And I think that's the dynamic that is set up these days. It's not always a sponsor. There's public companies too who do this.
But we do have a list of more aggressive sponsors that everyone knows about that are pushing this type of transactions.
We do. But back to the co-op, I think that's where the co-op comes in as a defensive mechanism so that the company, what has been taken off the table is particularly if there's a co-op that's signed by a vast majority of the lenders, 80-90%+, what the lenders have taken off the table is the ability for the company to do an up tier with just a small majority, say the CERTA type transaction. But again, companies aren't really doing that anyway, but that's often protected by a co-op. Now, co-ops have evolved also in complexity. And so we see co-ops that actually permit differentiated treatment between the small majority and other lenders, either in treatment generally or with respect to things like backstop fees.
Carve-out premiums.
Yeah. And so the co-ops have evolved themselves in complexity.
You've talked about your extensive experience working on LMEs. I'm curious, what are some of the lessons you learned from deals that ended in litigation or bankruptcy despite the LME efforts?
So look, with respect to some that have wound up in litigation, I think we've really learned the lesson that it's better to get everybody to participate, right? It's worth the effort. It's worth the potential extra cost to avoid the litigation. Litigation is incredibly expensive, incredibly sort of damaging to the business, and no company wants to end up litigating its liability management transactions. As to the many of them that end up in bankruptcy, you know, it's sort of the question everybody asks, like, were the LMEs worth it? Should you have done it? Or should you have just gone and fixed the business, you know, in a bankruptcy? I think every situation is different and has to be analyzed differently. But just because a company ended up in bankruptcy doesn't mean that the LME wasn't worth the shot, right? It gives the company a chance at survival, and some certainly survive and avoid bankruptcy, and others don't. Look, at the end of the day, a liability management transaction cannot fix a business in the same way that a bankruptcy can. But many bankruptcies, you don't fix the business anyway. You just do it as a financial restructuring, either a pre-pack or otherwise. You don't really impair your unsecured creditors or
22s.
Other things. Well, sometimes, yeah. And so I think you have to look at the business and just determine whether it's a business that would benefit from the contract rejection provisions of the bankruptcy code so that it could actually right-size the business, and whether that's worth the added cost of Chapter 11. Or if you were just going to do a financial restructuring and you have the ability to do a liability management transaction, then that may be a better route to at least start with.
Now, I guess before we wrap up, I just want to ask you a question regarding the market outlook. What would be your expectations for the LME market in the next 12 to 18 months? I know it's hard to predict with all the uncertainty and volatility caused by tariffs.
It is hard to predict. I think we're expecting LME activity to continue to be robust because it's logical. It makes sense. When you have so much liquidity in the private credit market and you have high interest rates and you have uncertainty in the market and companies have the ability to borrow in a structurally senior way, for many companies, it makes sense. We think it will continue. If the economy completely plummets, we'd probably see a lot more that would end up in Chapter 11. But if the economy sort of works its way out of this in a positive trajectory, then the LMEs that we're doing may very well proven to save the companies that are involved.
Now, I want to end the podcast full cycle because we talked about your music experience at the beginning of our conversation, but we kept the best for the end because you actually co-produced a Tony Award-winning Broadway show while working as a restructuring lawyer. Can you tell us more about your experience co-producing that show?
Sure. So I spent the first 15 years as a lawyer at Davis Polk, I did almost nothing related to my music background. And then something hit me in 2018 where, I don't know, it was 15 years or whatever. And I had a lot of success already as a Davis Polk partner. And I decided, you know what, like I had put that aside to focus on my practice of law and developing client relationships and all that and raising my children and everything. But I remembered that the reason I even picked up the LSAT book in the first place was because I wanted to get into the entertainment industry. So I thought about how could I scratch that itch just a little bit, right? And I ended up thinking about Broadway because I played over a dozen shows and earlier on and I had familiarity with it. I ended up cold calling a producer, this guy, Phil Kenny. He runs a producing club. And I told him about my background.
It's not
told
just him ask cold calling people every day at that wire. So yeah. You cold call a producer.
Exactly.
Okay.
Totally cold call. And I said what I'd be interested in. And he said, great. And he sent me the script and materials to Hadestown. I listened to the music and I read the script. And I said, this seems really great, like a show I would love to see. But it doesn't seem very commercial. Like, am I going to like lose all my money if I invest in that? And Phil said, you know, you may lose all your money, but you may not. It may do well. It may surprise you. It's a magical show. And he said that every year, the Best Musical Tony Award usually goes to a very artistic show. And this was the most artistic show that was out that year. It was coming out. Other shows were like The Prom. Like, they were fun shows. They were successful, but they weren't as sort of artistic. So he said, if you want to have a chance at winning a Tony, here's how much you have to come in for. And so I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. I loved the show. I believed in it. And so I committed to a certain amount, but then I ended up syndicating out a lot of the risk. So I ended up not putting all that much of my own money into it. It was less than a year later, I was on stage at Radio City Music Hall.
Accepting an award?
Winning a Tony Award. That happened really quickly, but it was really fun.
That's amazing, because I also understand that you came up with the idea for producing a big charity project where you worked with some of the biggest name drummers in the world to produce some sort of We Are the World for Drummers. Can you tell us more about how that project came about?
I thought about it in 2020, right after COVID hit. I had enjoyed that little producing foray into Hadestown. And with COVID, I didn't want to make it a profit-making enterprise for me. I didn't need that. And I thought that using my mix of interests and talents to raise money for charity, I thought would be really the right pathway, particularly during COVID, whenever there was so much hurt and pain around the world. And so I thought about, because all artists were grounded at the time, and I thought about doing like a video of top drummers doing sort of the same song. And I did it for the Harry Chapin's charity, Why Hunger? I've been very close to. They do tremendous work, anti-poverty work, and feeding the hungry all over the world. Harry Chapin was, for those who don't know, he was a great singer-songwriter in the 70s and a very passionate advocate for world hunger. And he used to donate more than half of his proceeds from concerts to this charity, White Hunger. And his father, Jim Chapin, was a great drummer. And I had met Jim Chapin as a kid. He's when I was studying at the Long Island Drum Center, he was there teaching, giving lessons. I took a lesson with him. And so sort of in his honor, I worked with a guy, Dom Famularo, who is a legendary drummer and drumming ambassador, and he knows everybody who's everybody. And so so I called him up on, I think it was the 40th anniversary of Harry Chapin's passing, and said, I have this idea. We should do it for Jim. We should do it for Harry. And he loved the idea. And he started making calls and calling around to all these top drummers. And we ended up choosing the song Come Together, the Beatles song. And we got Ringo Starr to do it. And we ended up getting Max Weinberg and, you know, Bruce Springsteen's drummer and Liberty DeVito and just over 100 top drummers around the world played on the album. And so I played on it too. I'm married into a family of all string players and my kids play strings. So in my living room, we had an 11 person string section, all of my family members playing strings on that. The charity ended up giving me the Harry Chapin Humanitarian Award at a big dinner the following year. We raised almost $1 million for Why Hunger.
That's amazing.
Through that in the middle of COVID. It was very successful. If you Google Drum Together, Why Hunger, or look it up on YouTube, you can see the video, but it was something I'm very proud of.
I'll definitely do it, and I hope our listeners will do the same. Brian, it was a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for taking the time to share your valuable insights.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of That Wired. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode via Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwired.com.